Maybe you can remember the first time you knew that Japanese Americans, many of them American citizens, were locked up by the federal government during the Second World War. When I first heard it, the description was of concentration camps in our own country because the government feared people of Japanese ancestry helping the other side after the attack on Pearl Harbor. The internment camps, prison camps if you prefer, and their inmates were well documented in photographs by excellent photographers, and their work is assembled in a new book of pictures and prose called Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. It's assembled by Richard Cahan and Michael Williams. Richard Cahan is a journalist who knows pictures. He worked at the Sun-Times in Chicago for nearly two decades, much of the time as picture editor. Now he curates photo exhibits and writes books like this one. Michael Williams is a constant companion in the book writing efforts of the co-authors of a dozen books, including two on Vivian Maier. Michael Williams, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Richard Cahan, welcome to you.
Hi. Thank you, Jim.
So, Richard, let's start with you. I mean, there's so much of Chicago in the work that you guys have done together up until this point. How did you get into this project?
Well, we were very much like you. We knew very little about the incarceration. We, in high school, when we talked about World War II, we talked about D-Day, and we talked about the War in the Pacific, and somehow Yalta, and somehow we never seemed to bring up the incarceration of 110,000 Japanese Americans. And it's something that I've always been interested in, and I've been attracted to the photographs that were taken by Dorothea Lange and other government photographers. So we decided to go to Washington, D.C., go to the National Archives where the pictures live, and really try to study them, understand them, and then set them in context.
So Michael Williams, help us understand the custody chain of these photographs. The government locked people up and then hired people to document this?
Yeah, it is strange and ironic. The WRA, this is the War Relocation Authority, hired about five photographers, a couple you may have heard of, including Dorothea Lange, to document nearly every facet of this process. This includes life on the West Coast for Japanese Americans before this took place, the notification, all the preparations that Japanese Americans had to make during that time to go to camps. They documented the life in the camps, and then it documented the return to normal society. So it's an amazing collection of 8,000 photographs that I think if you've read oral histories or if you've read histories on this before, the photographs make it all real. Because when you see pictures of soldiers taking away American citizens at gunpoint, when you see the piles of baggage, you know, at train stations ready to take people off to camps, it puts it in mind of what happened in Europe during World War II, and it just really kind of seems like an un-American thing. So I think it's these pictures that really make the stories come to life.
And it's much more than pictures. There are words here as well. And Richard Cahan, there are some that you prefer to use about this part of history. And notice the use of the term incarceration.
Right. We learned a lot about language as we put this book together. They always say that history is written by those who are victors, who win the wars, and I'm learning that language is also. The word internment, which is the word that I first, you know, always used about this, is the legal definition of internment. It's the taking a non-citizen and putting them in custody. And since 70,000 of the 110,000 Japanese Americans that were picked up were citizens, internment just isn't the right word. And I was asked by several survivors, why are you going to start your book with the word with a lie? Other words that are oftentimes used, assembly center. These were the first camps, the temporary camps that were built. And, of course, the assembly center connotes the idea of a parade and a fun time. Evacuation, another word that people use when talking about this era, that the government evacuated Japanese Americans, gives the impression that the Japanese Americans were in a storm or in a, that needed miraculous help. So we were very careful with the words. We start the book actually with a note about the words to explain exactly what we were doing.
Now, you do not use the term concentration camps, but when you concentrate people of a single ethnic group, it is technically correct, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think concentration camp is the correct word. That's exactly what happened. A lot of people use the word America's concentration camps. Mike and I had a problem with that term because of its connotations with the concentration camps in Nazi Germany, which were really death camps, not concentration camps. But because of that, we preferred to use detention facilities, jails, prisons.
Michael Williams, have the photographs all been seen before? I mean, did these all come to light of day earlier than now?
I think most people may have seen some of these pictures before, because when you were illustrating history books about this, you had very few choices, because for the most part, photojournalists and other documentarians were not allowed in the camps. So they relied on the use of these pictures to illustrate history books, some of which have become very iconic. But for the most part, you know, maybe a good two-thirds or three-quarters of these pictures really hadn't been seen before. And I think that's what makes our book new and different, is that we've been able to assemble a collection of photographs that really tells the entire story of the incarceration. And we do it through really particularly powerful and moving pictures.
I'm still kind of stuck on the idea that the War Relocation Authority itself hired the photographers, because I have to believe that, this might not have been something that the military powers that be would have wanted to see. I mean, did the left hand know what the right hand was doing here?
Well, you're right. I think it's all about control. I think if the government could keep other photographers out and kind of distribute photographs that they created, then they can control the story and can control the message. And I think that's what was happening here. What they didn't bargain for was the work of Dorothea Lange, which was so much more than just kind of typical newspaper or photojournalistic pictures. They're powerful pictures, and they kind of transcend far beyond just what was going on in the immediate range of the viewfinder. They transcended to create powerful and indicting documents about what was happening. So, yeah, it's an ironic situation, but at the same time, thank God, because if it wasn't for this record, there'd really be no other record of it.
All right, back to talk more about Un-American in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today are Richard Cahan and Michael Williams. They are curators of photography and authors as well, co-authors of several books about photography and photographers. Their latest documents the imprisonment of Japanese Americans during the Second World War. The book is called Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II, uses images that were actually shot by photographers employed by the War Relocation Authority, including Dorothea Lange and other government photographers. Ansel Adams makes a cameo appearance in here as well. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about not just the images, but what happened, the fact that Americans were imprisoned within their own country. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Richard Cahan, Oregon certainly appreciates having its former poet laureate Lawson Inada get the first words in the book. There are many, many people who ended up quite noteworthy who were contained in these camps, weren't there?
Oh, there certainly were. You know, it was an entire population of an important ethnic group in America. And so there were famous architects, there were dancers, there were artists, there were poets, you know, obviously. Most 9 out of every 10 Japanese Americans who lived in the United States at the time were picked up and removed.
And Lawson Inada's words, only what we could carry was the rule, so we carried strength, dignity, and soul. That's really only what we could carry. Did people have any idea how long they'd be gone or if they could come back to their property?
They had no idea whether they would be gone a week or a month or forever, to be honest, and they had no idea where they were going. They were showed up. Buses and trains took them oftentimes to temporary camps, and then they were taken to camps all over, mostly the West, but as far east as Arkansas and as far south as Arizona.
You mentioned the assembly centers, and in fact, one of them was the Santa Anita Racetrack, as you pointed out. I mean, were they staying in horse stalls and things like that?
That's exactly right. The Army built barracks in the parking lot of Santa Anita, but many people were actually living in horse stalls that had been whitewashed the week before. In fact, Portland had a large assembly center that was the Pacific International Livestock and Exposition Center, which is now the Portland Expo Center. And at the time, this was a livestock facility, and 11 acres were turned over so that families and people could be, in a sense, herded in, and they spent about 4 or 5 months there.
Before we get to the pictures, I want to take in a few more words here. There's a student, a man who was a student at Sacramento Junior College at the time, Kiyo Sato, who describes how the mood changed after Pearl Harbor. What did he describe?
Yeah, well, everything changed so quickly that day. Many people talked about how they were students in high schools, and all of a sudden, the Monday when they returned back, the hallways were absolutely empty. She talked about walking down the main hallway at Sacramento Junior College, and she would say, you know, hello to people, and no one even answered. You know, she described it as like the parting of the Red Sea, that students just turned away from her.
I said he. I meant she. Sorry about that.
No.
Michael, there's a picture in the introduction that is it's Dorothea Lange's picture of the Mitterai family, and it sounds like she went through a bit of a process fussing over which was going to be the good picture in that bunch.
Yes, you know, it's interesting. When I look at Dorothea's complete range of work for this project compared to the other photographers, her work was so precise, so perfect. She really wanted to take powerful pictures. And it's interesting, too, that she counted this among the best work of her career. She was so moved and affected by what she was seeing that she wanted to capture it. She knew it would be important. She knew that these photographs, in many cases, would be the only record of what was happening. So every picture was very important. It's also interesting to note that she really established many personal relationships with the people that she photographed. And there's many letters exchanged between Dorothea Lange and those that she photographed through the years. So this was something that wasn't just a quick one-off assignment for her. It was something that moved her and for the rest of her life.
Richard already gave us the numbers, 110,000 people locked up, 70,000 of them citizens. Michael, I mean, just how big a collection of photos could you possibly have started with at the National Archives?
Well, there's 8,000 images at the National Archives, and for some that seems like a lot. I think for many of us, particularly who know the story well, we were looking for specific pictures. We didn't always find what we were looking for. We didn't always find things that perhaps were the most controversial or the treatment was that was the harshest. But as I said before, this really is the only record. If we didn't have it, there would be no evidence of what took place. And I think that's how we approached this book. These photographs are evidence. These photographs are really, in many ways, the only record of what took place. And in that way, they're priceless. They're absolutely priceless.
How long a process to boil down from the original 8,000 to what you ended up with in this book?
I would say it went rather quickly because there were a lot of pictures that kind of bordered on, I guess, what you would call propaganda. These were pictures that the government took that they wanted to show off what they were doing, perhaps a new barracks or a new X-ray equipment. So we really went through those and kind of pushed those aside to find the most powerful ones. And I think I can speak for Rich, too, that for us the most powerful pictures were the ones that were taken during the process of taking people away. I think if you were given a week or a month to literally put all of our life in order, to store all of our possessions, to sell our houses, to sell our businesses, because we could no longer earn money, we couldn't pay our property taxes, we couldn't pay our mortgage. If you had just a matter of days or weeks to do that, it's obviously it would be nearly impossible. And there are pictures of that. There's pictures of people selling their businesses, selling their farm equipment, and they're incredibly moving and powerful. And I think that's what guided us. We wanted to find those pictures that would really resonate with people, that were filled with the power and the emotion of what was happening.
Michael Williams and Richard Cahan are the co-authors of a book of photographs from World War II of the incarceration of Japanese Americans. The book is called Un-American. Richard, to take the propaganda point a bit further, apparently some Japanese Americans dismissed the pictures as propaganda.
Right. After the war, there were people that obviously had suspicions of the government, and there's been a feeling for many years by some people that because they were taken by government photographers that they were propagandistic. Fortunately, the government hired the wrong people, especially Dorothea Lange. She had no interest in making this effort look good, and the government knew it right away that she had this ability to cut through cut through the ideas that this was a humane idea, and she really showed the feelings that people had on the day that they were picked up and their first hours in camps.
And the pictures are well chosen, too. That first picture of the farm family sitting in what appears to be their Sunday best on their front step in California just really kind of takes your breath away. The picture of the Mitterai family that I mentioned earlier.
Right.
And, you know, although Dorothea Lange said she never posed pictures, I mean, the fact is she clearly did fuss over this one from your description of it.
Oh, I think that all photographers fuss over their pictures. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think she really wanted to always get the best from all of her subjects. So whenever you look at a photographer, you'll see lots and lots of pictures. But I had a chance to talk to Dorothea Lange's granddaughter recently, and I asked her how was she able to get so close to people, like her famous migrant mother picture mm-hmm. taken. And she said, well, my grandmother had polio. She walked with a limp. She walked very slowly, and she really cared about people. And people sensed all this and, in effect, opened their lives and opened their hearts to her.
I understand, too, from talking to the granddaughter myself just a couple of weeks ago, that a lot of it had to do with that double lens reflex as well. She was looking down into the camera instead of having it in front of her face.
You know, people say that, as you mentioned, we've done a couple books on Vivian Meyer, and people say that mm-hmm. camera helps photographers. I'm not exactly sure, because it does let you look down at the camera instead of look at the subject. But both of these photographers, I think, were so comfortable with the camera that I think oftentimes they did look at people. And I think that you can tell that there's an exchange of eyes mm-hmm. in most of these pictures.
Okay. Let's take a call here. We have Mark in Reading on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Richard Cahan and Michael Williams, the co-authors of Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Yeah, I was fortunate enough to grow up next door to a couple, one of whom had been interned and the other not, because she and her family were in the Great Plains and long way from the ocean. Unfortunately, some patriots decided it was necessary to burn down their restaurant.
Oh, boy.
But George didn't talk much about being in the camps, but he did talk about when he got out, because he was willing to go with the military, and he didn't go. He went to Okinawa, and they wanted him to go around and find out what was going on with the locals, and of course they could tell him from a mile away. He said, you know, he was an American, you know, and of course the morons that were his bosses didn't see it that way, but the locals definitely did. Anyway, my question is, do you have the? I understand that Ansel Adams wasn't allowed to take photos of the fences and guard towers when he was in the camp. So he went outside and went up in the hills and took a photo from a distance that they didn't know about that showed the fences and guard towers. I'm wondering if that's in your book.
Go ahead.
We do have pictures of the camp that he took, the overall of the camp. I don't think we have any pictures of the guard towers. I've never really seen that. But you're right. That was the one prohibition that all the photographers had. The government didn't want to show the barbed wire and guard towers, although some of those photos were impounded at the time. They're still at the National Archives, and those photos are in the book.
And that's a really interesting question about Ansel Adams, because as we approached this project, we were very aware that Ansel Adams took a lot of heat for the photographs that he produced. What he did was, when he came to camp, he really didn't focus on documenting the camp, as you might expect many documentary photographers to do, but he was a nature photographer primarily, so he didn't focus on that. But what he did do was he allowed himself to be moved by what he saw, and he was so moved by the dignity and the ability to persevere in the face of such adverse conditions that's what he did. He documented in a series of portraits and other photographs the incredible dignity with which the Japanese Americans were facing and dealing with what they're up against. And those photographs are incredibly enduring. And so while Rich and I were very initially reluctant to use those photos, ultimately we decided we should use them because they were powerful documents. And if you don't ask more than he gave in that collection of photographs, then they really are an important piece of this puzzle, so we chose to include them.
Why was Ansel Adams running? He was not a regular worker for the War Relocation Authority, was he, Michael?
No, he wasn't. He had a relationship with somebody at Manzanar who allowed him to photograph. As far as we know, there was no restrictions put on him other than the ones we previously talked about. But I think he was really moved by what was going on, and he wanted to photograph it. And he, too, just like Dorothea Lange, went on to say that this was among the most powerful work that he ever produced. And I think if you see the pictures, you can see it. You can see it in them. They are among his best work.
Rich, I want to talk about the decision to incarcerate in the first place and the military-civilian crossover of authority there. I mean, did FDR essentially delegate this?
He did. Executive Order 9066, which came 11 weeks after Pearl Harbor on February 19th, so we're closing in on the 75th anniversary, was was actually an order that said that the Secretary of War should make the decision of who should be excluded from what areas. And in effect, at first glance, you think to yourself, well, the military was responsible for the security of America, so it makes sense that the Secretary of War would do something like this. But on the other hand, the War Department had no concerns, no interest, and no responsibility over the civil liberties of the Japanese Americans. So even though there were so many citizens in this group, they were never charged, they were never tried, and they were simply told to report and taken away.
What kinds of stories were told to justify incarceration?
Well, there was a real worry that Japan would attack the West Coast. They had bombed Pearl Harbor. Over 2,000 Americans had died there. 2 days later, there were blackout drills in San Francisco. So there was a real war hysteria that started immediately. There were fears that Japanese Americans would spy for their home country, their original home country. There were fears that they would create sabotage on the West Coast, and fears that they would collaborate with invaders if they ever hit the coast. So there was this true worry. It was absolutely based on nothing. There was no reports. No one has ever tried. No one has ever convicted of any of this.
Sounds like in-person voter fraud.
Well, what it is, and one thing I learned, is that hysteria makes us make very irrational and bad decisions.
Antonin Scalia, the late Supreme Court justice, is quoted in the introduction. What did he say about camps?
Antonin Scalia said that no matter how many laws there are in the country, that when fear spreads across America in times of war or times of pre-war, the country's laws become basically transparent. The laws, the laws don't remain. That people take matters in a sense into their own hands.
We're talking about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II, which is also the subtitle of the book by Richard Cahan and Michael Williams, Un-American, which collects a lot of amazing photographs from that period. We have talked a lot about Dorothea Lange, Michael. Let's branch out and talk about Clem Albers, one of the other WRA photographers.
You know, Clem's work, I think, has been underappreciated. It's interesting. We've kind of used Dorothea Lange as kind of our guide to follow when we select other pictures. But I think Clem's work, I think he might have done the same thing, because his work also transcends just what was before him. His work, particularly the documenting of what was going on at the time, again, it's got a power to it that, and I love news photography, I love photojournalism. We've made many books on photojournalism. But I think the mark of a great photographer is to allow yourself to be moved by what you see and try to react to that and try to capture that. I think when you were talking earlier about kind of the cameras used, the twin lens reflex, these different things, I think those things can help. But what it really takes to make a great photographer is a soul and a heart, and to be allow yourself to be moved by what you see and try to capture that. And I think that's what he did. I think there's a number of photographers who worked for the authority who did that. And again, I think Dorothea's work was kind of the guide for that. And we tried to choose other photographs that photographers had taken to kind of fill in those gaps, but capture that intensity and that emotional quality to them.
That must be a tricky line to walk for a photojournalist, though, to allow yourself to feel enough to get involved, essentially, enough to have a feel for it reflected in the photograph you take, but at the same time not to get taken away with it.
That's a good question. I think, a lot of these photographs, they were taken under incredibly tense and anxious conditions. There's photographs from San Pedro of angry crowds watching the Japanese Americans being removed. And you can see in their faces kind of this hysterical looks. And I think there would be a lot of pressure on photographers to not capture that, to not be kind of, you would be intimidated almost to take those pictures. So I think it's a real mark of how good a journalist, photojournalist, these people were, that they did not allow that to seep in. They saw what was before them. They captured it. They weren't intimidated. It's interesting, I think, as people go through the book, you'll see pictures like that. There's lots of very difficult-to-look-at pictures in that way, because what was happening was just unimaginable. I think when I was going through the pictures looking at these, I tried to put myself in the position of the Japanese and think, how could I have how could I have, you know, dealt with it? How could I have endured this? And that's what's special about this collection is they did get those shots. They didn't back down.
They really did. We'll talk more about the photographs that tell the story of the internment, the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. The book is called Un-American. Michael Williams and Richard Cahan, co-authors and our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more about this period in American history. And you can join us by phone or by email as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Richard Cahan and Michael Williams, who are longtime journalists and photographers and curators of photographic works, about the book they've assembled, one of several they've put together about photographers and photography. This one is called Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. It has the benefit of pictures from notable photographers like Dorothea Lange and Ansel Adams. Dorothea Lange was one of several people who worked for the War Relocation Authority, the very same government agency that required the incarceration of Japanese Americans on the West Coast, also hired photographers to document the process. And that gives us the benefit of having a much better record of what happened at that time. You can join the conversation about incarceration and that period in human history on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Michael, we were just talking about a fascinating picture I just flipped to in the book that Clem Albers took of non-Japanese Americans standing arms folded on the sidewalk in San Pedro, California, on April 5th, 1942, watching the Japanese Americans get taken away. There was another picture I wanted to juxtapose with that and ask about, which it turns out is also by Clem Albers, on the same day, showing the arrival in Santa Anita with lots of guns and guards. That juxtaposition is just amazing to me, and it's only a few pages apart, and again, same day.
Yeah, such a powerful picture. And pictures like the one you're talking about of the guard towers, there's not a lot of them. So that is a really important and powerful picture. I think that when you read history books, and I've read a lot of stories and a lot of nonfiction books about what took place, it resonates, but until you see a picture like that, until you see pictures like both of those that you're talking about, you really don't get that sense of the mood of the country and how intense this must have been for people to go through. So as documents, those, they really do transcend just as a documentary picture. They, in some ways, kind of capture that the mood of, and the spirit of the country at that time.
Clem Albers apparently had more of his photos impounded than anybody else in the WRA. Was it because he took pictures of things like people in uniform and guard towers?
I think it was more about the year. He photographed mostly in 1942. Things were very tense at that time, and that was really the opportunity to get those kinds of pictures. I think as the years went on, and after people were incarcerated, those opportunities didn't exist anymore. But particularly in his early stuff, taken in Los Angeles, you see storefronts of going out of business sales in Los Angeles. These are the businesses that Japanese Americans had to sell and liquidate very quickly. Oh, they're such powerful documents. It must have been unimaginable for these families to go through this. And it's great that we have these documents to see.
Rich Cahan, can you tell us about Francis Stewart, the third photographer hired?
Sure. Francis Stewart knew Dorothea Lange, so we're guessing that he was recommended by her. And he was actually hired, in a sense, to replace her, because the War Relocation Authority was understood early on that Dorothea Lange was not sympathetic to their cause. And there were we found letters. Francis Stewart's son shared letters that talked about the WRA's worries of Dorothea Lange asking questions of people who were registering. And he was a very talented, skilled photographer. He was grew up in, he went to school in Los Angeles and worked for San Francisco newspapers. And like Lange and Albers, he was a photojournalist who had a great artistic sensitivity. And we've been all very impressed with his pictures. Lange lasted about 3 months. Albers lasted only a few months. And Francis Stewart really lasted less than a year, too. This was an upsetting situation to see and witness, and it caused, to Lange, it caused a nervous condition and ulcers, and to the other photographers, they wanted nothing to do with it after a few months.
Well, three more names, too, of people who got hired by the War Relocation Authority: Tom Parker, Charles Mace, and then a real surprise, Hikaru Carl Iwasaki.
Exactly. Carl Iwasaki was alive when we did the book. He died in September in his 90s. He was actually a internee at Heart Mountain and in Wyoming. He was hired by the WRA to work in the darkroom, and obviously he did so well that they hired him to work as a photographer. They sent him all around the country showing where Japanese Americans were moving after the camps, all the way down to New Orleans, all the way back to California. He took beautiful work and ended up being a photographer for Time Life and Sports Illustrated and had a long and an illustrious career.
Why was he given such free rein, given what was, I mean, the fact he was an internee to begin with?
Well, remember, he was given free rein far away from the West Coast.
Ah. So
Japanese Americans, you know, in the Middle West and the East could, you know, weren't restricted. There's an interesting story that he told me. He went down to New Orleans and he saw the streetcars and he saw the whites sitting in front of the blacks on streetcars. And here is a man who had just come from the camps. He had absolutely no idea where his place was. Does he, you know, sit behind the whites? Does he sit in front of the blacks? Does he sit behind the blacks? And soon he was kind of told that he could sit with the whites. It says something about our society, our nation.
Truly. You know, you mentioned that he was able to roam away from the West Coast. The exclusion zone's obviously on the West Coast. So what options did the people in the camps have to move somewhere else in the country?
Well, if they could find a sponsor and if they could find a community that was not belligerent, believe it or not, it somehow was their responsibility, they could leave the camps if they also had jobs. And of the 110,000, about 30,000 of them did leave the camps during those 3 years, and they settled in places like Utah and Chicago and, you know, points east of California, Oregon and Washington.
So I mean, when we mentioned that there was some level of censorship here, and certainly overall during the Second World War, a lot of censorship and a lot of self-censorship, too, you know, prompted by the posters like "Loose Lips Sink Ships," so don't speak up. So how public a debate was there, Rich, about or knowledge, for that matter, of what was going on in these camps?
Well, we looked carefully at the opposition to the whole process, and I'm sad to say that we looked at local papers through mostly California, and there were very few people who stood up and wrote letters to the editor or who took stands at assemblies. There was this feeling, there was a worry about the Japanese Americans. I think there was an envy. They had really distinguished themselves as farmers because they worked so hard, and people didn't take a stand, which is something I think we should remember in this day when we talk about Muslim registries. Once they were removed from their homes, they were hardly mentioned. It was as if the Japanese Americans did not live in Oregon or California.
You mentioned Muslims. That brings up an email from one of our listeners, Wolfgang in Sunny Valley, who writes, "The Nazis photographed their camps to validate and justify themselves and their motives. It was also a factor of dehumanizing the Jews. There was nothing wrong with killing things, or vermin is the way they looked at it." He writes that, most importantly, the same rhetoric in the USA, and he says the same rhetoric today by Trump, any Muslim, etc. This includes citizens. "Thanks for dealing with my typos," writes Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. So you're concerned that the same sort of thing could happen again?
Well, I think that there are parallels. Recently, Carl Higbee, a very important Trump supporter, former Navy SEAL, said on the Megyn Kelly show in November that the internment was a precedent for the Muslim registry. I think that this book does have relevance because I think anyone who looks at the book carefully will see that it indeed is a precedent, but it's a very bad precedent. It shows us the wrong road to go down. But he also used words like he's certain that the registry is constitutional. It's the same words that we read time and time again as we researched 1941 and 1942 and the Justice Department saying that all this was constitutional. It turned out that the camps were opened in late 1944, the day before the Supreme Court was going to decide. And obviously they were going to decide that it was unconstitutional, and that's why the government took steps to do it. So I think it's important for us to think about Americans who are considered others. I think it's important to stand up. And you know, one thing that Mike and I did, and I think readers will do as they look through the book, it makes you think to yourself, what would you do? You mentioned the photograph in San Pedro, people standing on the corner. you know, would I have stood on the corner? Would I have smiled? Would that have driven me to action? And the other thing I learned is if you are going to resist, you have to resist early, because once the machinery of government stops, it's very hard to stop it. If it starts, it's very hard to stop it.
You know, and as the book points out, too, that the restrictions at that time were particularly severe on people closest to military facilities. And so, Michael, can you tell us about, for example, what happened in Terminal Island in Los Angeles?
Well, I think what happened there, really what happened up and down the West Coast, it's unfortunately, it was a process that once it begun, it was almost impossible to stop. And in my mind, if we look at the world today, if we look at America today, and something like this were to start, theoretically you would find potential hazards everywhere we look at. I think that they made excuses during this period of many Japanese were living close to perhaps airports, shipping terminals, areas of great military interest. Well, of course, if you look at the world around us, these kinds of things are absolutely everywhere. So it's kind of an absurd notion to try to use those as excuses for this. Unfortunately, at the time, there was this hysteria, and it got out of control. And I think it's, as Rich has said earlier, it's really important to know that it's this kind of hysteria that once it starts, it's hard to stop. And I really think, and we've heard this from many Japanese Americans, that the relationship between Japanese Americans and the rest of America was harmed for decades and decades after this happened. And this was a relationship that before the war, it was great. It was an integrated West Coast where people lived and went to school together. But just this process put such fear and suspicion into Americans that it just harmed it irreparably. There was vandalism, there was violence, and this lingered for decades after the war. So it's really a cautionary tale as we go forward. Once this starts, it can make things even worse and worse, because that's really what the evidence shows.
Was there any parallel to the treatment of German-American families on the East Coast, for example? Because there was a sizable German community in New York, for example. Richard?
There were about 10 or 11,000 German nationals that were picked up by the FBI and questioned, but there were no U.S. citizens U.S. citizens that were ever taken away and put in camps.
Hmm. So, you know, I guess it's been said many times to the point where probably some people's eyes roll, but my jaw hits the floor every time I realize that there was Earl Warren was a central figure in the relocation.
He was. The book has many heroes in it, and it has a few villains, and Earl Warren was certainly one of them. Before his years on the Supreme Court, he was the Attorney General of California, and I guess it was politically expedient to come out against Japanese Americans in 1941. He created a map showing where every Japanese American lived in California in front of a congressional hearing in early 1942, and then he overlaid it with ports and radio transmission towers and army base facilities, and his point was, is he wanted to show everyone how Japanese Americans had purposefully took up residence around these facilities, implying that there was going to be a revolution against them. And when he was asked by congressional investigators, he was asked, well, there's been no reports of sabotage, there's been no reports of any collaboration. Earl Warren turned it around and he said, that's exactly the point. They're so secretive, they would never give away their game plan before it happened, and that makes them even more dangerous. Later in life, in some memoirs, he half-heartedly apologized for it, but certainly his later career was not like this.
No, and I have to wonder if there's any speculation among historians that Earl Warren might have been the guy to lead the Brown versus Board of Education decision, for example, 9 years after the war, because of his experience with Japanese Americans during the war.
Yes, I think that's a possibility. It's never been related in his letters, but I've heard that too, that he may have learned from it.
So for either of you, about a minute left, is there one picture that rises above all others that you can't get out of your mind, Rich?
Well, I think there's a picture of an 11-year-old girl by the name of Rachel Karuma, and she's it's just a beautiful portrait of an innocent 11-year-old wearing her blouse looks very Japanese, and and she was picked up, and we ended up finding her. She had no idea about the picture, and she looked at the picture with me, and she confirmed that it was her. She's now obviously she's 84 years old now, and we talked about her experiences during the war, and she just, you know, she looked at the picture and she said, "I was quite presentable then."
And Mike, is there a picture that does that for you?
Well, I think I always return to this picture taken by Dorothea Lange in 1942 of the sign "I am an American" hanging in front of a
grocery store.
Yeah, it's just so powerful, and I really cringe at thinking that we might return to those days again where people have to make those kinds of statements.
The book can make you cringe, but it certainly also makes you think that the photography is gorgeous, even if what was happening in the pictures was not gorgeous. The book is called Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II, images from Dorothea Lange and Ansel Adams and others. Richard Cahan and Michael Williams, great job. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey.